So on the substance, net neutrality, right? So this is the principle that your internet service providers shouldn't be able to block, throttle, or otherwise discriminate against particular internet content. The FCC repealed the rules that we adopted in 2015 and 2017, and that has made Democrats very, very angry.
Can I ask, have we seen, and it became something of a meme, that there were going to be all these horrible consequences as a result of that repeal? We certainly haven't all died. I know people make jokes about that, so that's good news. But have we seen any actual negative consequences thus far since the repeal of this rule that obviously wasn't the rule until it was instituted under Obama when it comes to net neutrality?
Well, absolutely. Actually, there have been. And let's not laugh too much about physical harm, because I think the best, frankly, worst example happened in California during the Mendocino Complex fire this summer.
That was Gigi Sohn, who used to be a former counselor to the Obama administration era Federal Communications Commission. She was talking there with Buck Sexton, if that's his real name, and it's not, on The Hill TV, talking about net neutrality. Hi, everyone. This is Matt Welch. Welcome to the Reason Podcast Editors Roundtable edition here. I'm with my colleagues, Catherine Mangu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Peter Suderman.
Hello.
Good morning, everyone.
Hey. Happy Monday.
I believe it or not, I think we can hear this and have it broadcasted over the internet, even though it's, you know, it's audio. So I guess the mass extinction event didn't happen. Starting unusually, perhaps, with a discussion on net neutrality, because I think too often in our constantly hysterical hot take landscape, media landscape, political landscape here, we forget moments of past mass extinction events, whatever they might be. And this one was pretty hot and heavy, and something The Reason and all four of us, there's four of us on this discussion, have written about at various times before, during, and after. And I think it's worth dwelling on because there's some of the same kind of attitudes and approaches, not just towards internet regulation, but about media and content that are worth reflecting on in, going in the future. So that is my stammery way of getting to a bit of this conversation. And I want to start with Suderman, since you wrote a long feature for Reason Magazine about the kind of left-bent fight towards net neutrality, the kind of heavier-handed regulation to make sure that internet service providers didn't do terrible, awful things that no one hadn't really ever done. If you could just sort of give us a quick eyeball summary of where we are a year after this. The internet's what, 40% faster? Why didn't the thing happen that was supposed to be evil that happened?
Where we are is on the internet still, which is working basically fine. It's working, if anything, better than ever. Internet speeds are up 40% this year, according to a report in Recode, and all of the kind of digital online apocalypse that we were supposed to be living through here for the last year just didn't happen at all, because net neutrality was always a kind of a solution to a problem that didn't exist. And, you know, usually with regulation, the way it works is that something bad happens, or something that somebody, let's at least say something that somebody doesn't like. There is a negative outcome that that somebody is objecting to that is already real in the world. With net neutrality, the regulations were entirely prophylactic. They were responding to things that hadn't happened yet. And now that net neutrality has been pulled back by under Ajit Pai and the Obama administration, none of the bad things that were supposed to happen have happened yet still. And in fact, the internet speeds, you know, it's getting faster. And that's in part due to more investment, which was a big concern that net neutrality would itself cause some bad things, which mainly that it would say, hey, ISPs, all you people who sort of you big companies that spend a lot of money making our internet faster, we're going to regulate the hell out of you. We're going to basically treat you like a public utility. That was the idea under the Obama administration. And so the concern was that they would be pulling back on investment and not spend as much money, because that's sort of how utilities work and how companies respond when they are told that they're going to be treated effectively like a utility. And so I actually want to just add another point here, which is that in retrospect, I think it has become clear that a big part of the net neutrality advocacy was the push was that Democrats, progressives, folks on the left viewed the big ISPs, so that's companies like AT&T and Verizon, the delivery systems, as kind of political enemies and as kind of not part of their culture. And similarly, a huge amount of the push to regulate social media and to regulate big tech companies that exist on the coasts, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, companies like that comes from a kind of middle American, sort of more conventionally conservative and Republican sense that those people are coastal, progressive, liberal elitists. And it's not really even about any particular policy. It is about just saying we want to exercise political power over the people who are not like us. And in a lot of ways, they're really flip sides of the same coin. And I think that it is driven by some really kind of stupid, nasty, and pointless partisan cultural senses that, like, these guys just aren't on our side and aren't like us, and therefore we need to exercise political power over them.
Nick, I remember when net neutrality was adopted by in the late Obama administration, feeling a sense of personal failure. In that I felt like in the cultural discussion, the net cultural discussion, which, you know, we've been a part of for a long time and know a lot of the people who are kind of leading advocates on the net neutrality side of it. It felt like we lost. We just didn't like the ethics of the early 90s kind of era of the internet of like, hey, kind of don't touch it unless you really have to. But let's just err on the side of not touching it had lost. Do you
always
do
good you advice? Think,
do you think that in the wake of this, do you have any hope of regaining that? Or in the Peter sense of things, are we just now locating the enemies and figuring out ways to regulate against them?
Yeah, I think it's more that the kind of the territory being surveilled has changed a little bit. So now it's not about the fixation on controlling the internet or regulating or what matters isn't that last mile of fiber into your house anymore, which is under net neutrality. That's what people were talking about how ISPs were going to be able to extort both consumers as well as producers of content to say, hey, if you want to see this, you're going to have to pony up and pay, you know, an extra $10 to get Netflix at a decent streaming rate and all of that kind of stuff. That's gone away. And what has happened instead is that, you know, the legislative energy and the regulatory energy more broadly is now on the companies themselves that tend to be platforms. Part of this is, you know, ISPs and phone companies have been merging and changing, and they are now kind of agglomerations that they really weren't even a few years ago, where it was pretty clear that you could say, you know, like Time Warner, which doesn't exist as an ISP anymore. That was an ISP and Verizon was a phone company. Now they are all kind of morphed and changed into various types of different entities that blend things. And then you throw in the fact that Verizon, Comcast, other major ISPs are also content providers now, AT&T doing this too, that it changes the stakes. But what people are focused on now, and I agree that it's shifting the energy, but it's kind of the same mindset, is, okay, we're going to worry less about regulating the kind of technical backdrop of all of this stuff. And instead, now we're looking at companies such as Facebook, as Google, as Twitter. You know, this in many ways is more disturbing, but I think it also does speak, Matt, to that kind of end of the period of the, you know, the 25-year period where the internet became a mass medium via the World Wide Web, and there was a lot of utopianism and a lot of forward momentum and a lot of people, kind of arguing in favor of a wide open Wild West approach. But nobody in Washington is arguing for that anymore, and a shrinking number of people within the kind of cyber community, EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, their co-founder, John Perry Barlow, 26 years ago or so, 25, 26 years ago, released the Declaration of Independence in Cyberspace. EFF is now constantly talking about how to regulate, large companies as well as your internet connections. Things have changed.
Catherine, you are a robot. and hang out with, you know, I remember when the Boing Boing was a directory of wonderful things like robots, and that's kind of how it was, rather than wanting to choke out Ajit Pai on a daily basis. Do you have a sense at all that there's a moment's hesitation among people who are absolutely hysterical about this? Hysterical, I think, wrong. But certainly, at the very least, hysterical, even if they were right on this. Have you seen any sense that a year later, people are like, you know what, maybe we were kind of exaggerating a little bit. Maybe this is cause for reflection on the way that we approach all kinds of things going in the future.
A million times no. Like, why would you even ask me that?
I mean, I want hope.
This is, you know, NBC had this summary of what the world was going to be like post-net neutrality, which Eric Boehm pulled out in honor of the one-year anniversary at the end of last week. Try this scenario on for size, colon. You wake up, reach for your phone, and head to your favorite news site to check the headlines, but instead of the latest news, you see a message from your cell phone carrier. This site is not available. Please upgrade to our deluxe package to access it. Dun, dun, dun. Like, first of all, obviously not that. Second of all, if that, it's okay, because there are a lot of other websites, which I think is like, it sounds like an overly simplistic thing to say, but like the sort of implicit in both the net neutrality arguments and now in the new wave of arguments that Peter is pointing to, where like the bad big thing is the social media companies instead of the ISPs. Like in both of those cases, we just continue to gloss over the fact that you could just not use the thing and that that would not actually be the end of the world. You could not go to NBCnews.com. You could just not go to Facebook.
And part of the scaremongering for both the net neutrality and the social media regulation is that there is the fear that companies will censor political speech.
Right.
So we certainly see that a lot with social media, with this sort of banning conservatives. But that was a big fear with the ISPs would censor political content, news that they didn't want you to see.
And now the whole deal is like, we're going to need you guys to censor political content.
Yeah.
Like that's,
I mean, right?
How do we know if it's even true?
Like clockwork now. That's like, hey, could everyone please censor the political content? Because, I don't know, politics seems sort of scary right now. And sometimes things that aren't true are on the internet. I mean, just in general, like, always political speech these days, this century even, falls into this weird category where we're like, yes, freedom of speech is absolute. It's so important to protect freedom of speech. Our founders knew that it was important to protect freedom of speech. But here's the thing we're not going to do. You probably shouldn't say really mean and even potentially untrue things about powerful people. And it's like, wait, hold on. That was the whole point.
So, what do you think is the deeper anxiety here? You know, and it clearly has something to do with politics and the intersection of technology and politics, both in the driving the net neutrality debate and its most basic level, because it was, you know, that company was going to block or throttle speech, mostly political speech they didn't like. That's happening on, you know, this is one of the big fears of Facebook that, you know, either it's pumping out Russian bot stuff that fucks over Hillary Clinton, or it is shadow banning Diamond and Silk so that they don't get the 10 million, you know, followers that they want. What is it?
So don't you think, it's that?
I just wanted to ask, is this anxiety only coming from the political class, or is it actually something like, do regular users feel like they're not able to get the content that they want? Because it seems to me that easy read is the political class knows that they have lost control of conversations because there are lots of ways where people can ignore them and people can rat around them and whatnot, and that this is their way of trying to get back to controlling the conversation. But I'm curious if you guys agree with that, but then also, like, does the common user have that experience as well, that they can't get the information they really need?
So I think a generous interpretation is that people are aware that they are increasingly reliant on, certain companies or industries to give them true information, right? They are reliant on, and people used to worry, okay, we're reliant on our ISPs to let that information through the series of tubes, and now we, you know, we're worried about social media companies and other content sharing platforms. I think the less generous interpretation is the elite political class doesn't trust the rubes to know when they're being lied to, and so we have to make sure that the elite political class is at the very least heavily involved in, if not actually in charge of, making the decisions about what information comes through. So I think, you know, the underlying anxiety of, like, people are filtering the information I see for reasons extrinsic to my own desires, like, that's a legit anxiety. And I think people feel it on many levels, but mostly I think ordinary people don't worry about that. And you can see this with the Chinese internet, right? Like, the internet is heavily censored, heavily filtered, heavily monitored in China, but most users say and behave as if they are essentially free. They just don't go looking in places where political speech might live. It's sort of an understood taboo. And so it feels free-ish even while being fundamentally unfree. I think people are worried that could be happening here, but the way to deal with that worry is not to actually make it unfree by giving control of the internet to political elites.
I am going to propose a new theory, which is that stuff that it's obvious the normals don't care about, which I would definitely include net neutrality. I really don't think that penetrated in any meaningful sense to end users who don't pay a hyper amount of attention either to tech policy or stupid media debates. But you could even argue that to some degree, a lot of the climate change, global warming debate, it's much a broader penetration, but it's never, as far as I know, has risen to any kind of polling level as like an immediate term concern of voters at any given point. And so whatever the issue is that you, good standing member of the hyper plugged in class, the distance between that and like exciting somebody out there, you've got to engage in nonstop threat inflation. And I say this, I can hear people already getting mad at me because, you know, if you warm the planet, it's actually, you know, a serious thing. I agree that it is a serious thing. But the kind of rhetoric that's associated with it, including like short term, holy cow rhetoric out there, I think it's people are just using the electroshocks they used to use on, you know, emergency, Nick? Mm-hmm. Randolph Mantooth, yeah, sure. Was just, you know,
the paddles.
The paddles right mm-hmm. there to try to reanimate them.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's what we're engaging in. I want to try to have some explanation on a thing that I don't fully understand. And maybe I'll throw this to Suderman first, but I know Nick knows it as well. But there's a lot of discussion in this talk about regulating. A lot of discussion coming from kind of the conservative and libertarian flavored conservative right of that Section 230 of the Internet or Communication Decency Act or whatever the hell from 1996 needs to be applied now to companies that don't normally think of themselves as publishers. And this is a reason why we really need to crack down on fill in the blank. Peter, can you walk me through that? Or can if you feel overwhelmed by the thing, if Nick can. But like, what is the claim that we need to refute that's central to this idea about regulating internet companies?
Section 230 is basically the provision of 90s era communications law that basically says that publishers online cannot be held legally liable for the content that they publish that is submitted by users. So Craigslist can't be sued for somebody uploading something that might be illegal, defamatory, dangerous, just because Craigslist is not out there monitoring or filtering or et cetera. And that in addition, they also have the ability to do some amount of editing and cleanup of some sort, in part because the worry was that if you actually prohibited them, if you on the one hand said, well, you have no legal liability as long as you're totally neutral, then what they couldn't do would be to go in and say, edit out rape threats or horrible stuff that was done. And so that was why Section 230 protections basically exist. And this was used to go after Backpage, which Backpage.com, which was an adult ads site, somewhat along the lines of Craigslist, except that unlike Craigslist, they didn't sort of immediately fold when told to get rid of all of their adult advertising. Elizabeth Nolan Brown has written extensively about this and profiled the founders. But basically, conservatives want to start, or I shouldn't say all conservatives, but there is a group of right-of-center lawmakers, and some on the left as well, who really would like to limit Section 230 protections for big publishers. And in fact, without giving away too much, I was in one of these, you know, I live in Washington, and so I was in one of these private, off-the-record encounters with someone who is a prominent person on the right who kind of deals with this sort of thing. And to bring it back to what I was saying before, I asked, well, so why is this necessary if users can just leave, if there is actually, we see that users have a considerable amount of market power in the tech space, and that antitrust and that all of these other sort of regulatory interventions against big tech companies tend to, at the very best, just be too slow to work. You can go back and look at Microsoft. And the answer I got was basically, well, you know, sort of the people where I come from, they think that the big tech companies don't share their values. And they're distrustful of them because the big tech companies don't care about people like where I come from. And it was just a kind of pure culture war argument that this is a thing, this is a legal protection that has helped out liberal coastal blue state tech types who don't live like people in the middle of the country do. And it was just amazing to hear this. Again, this was you know, sort of a private forum. This is not the argument that is being made quite as explicitly in public, but I think that's a real driver here for all of these regulations, in that Section 230 is in some ways just sort of, they were searching around for something they could go after in order to put pressure on tech companies as part of this sort of part of a kind of culture war attack on coastal big tech companies.
Nick, you paid attention to the hearings on Capitol Hill. I think it was last week, where a lot of this. How would you assess the kind of argumentation there by lawmakers of both sides, but even particularly the Republican side, kind of an appetite for getting into a kind of regulation that at one point in living memory, it would seem hard to imagine Republicans arguing.
Yeah, no, they're explicitly starting to talk about antitrust, but also about Section 230. And so Bob Goodlatte, who ran the hearing for Google CEO last week, actually explicitly talked about how, you know, it'd be one thing if Google was just like a flat search engine and it didn't spin the results in a particular direction, you know, then there wouldn't be any issue. But given that it's doing that, or it seems to be doing that, in order that Republicans and conservatives do less well in search, do less well at YouTube, do less well at various kind of things that are downstream from the search engine, because everybody assumes everybody at Google wants to destroy Republicans and conservatives. He brought up the idea of conceivably weakening 230 immunity and saying, you know what, like, you're not, you know, we should be getting rid of that, or we should be relooking at that and minimizing it. Other people like Louis Gohmert actually said, you know, basically said that as long as you are not being a fair and equal kind of publisher of all content, you know, you should not have that immunity. There's no evidence that you know, Google or Twitter or Facebook is choking down certain points of views with any kind of systematic way. You know, there's always stuff happening on. And in fact, in the when it comes to Facebook, it turns out that Donald Trump's pages have higher engagement rates than reach and engagement rates than Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and things like that. But that fear that Republicans are being and conservatives are being systematically underserved by these platforms is something that gives Republicans, conservatives who typically are against regulation, basically calling for something like a fairness doctrine in cyberspace, or warning that we have to go back and amend Section 230, which also ran afoul of people who tended to be more on the left, or not more on the left, but included people on the left when they were going after child online child sex trafficking. And these were the laws like FOSTA and SESTA, where they wanted to weaken certain types of 230 immunity if the activity that was being published or described was somehow related to whatever got defined as online child sex trafficking, things like that. Then on top of it, last week you also had a guy who is going to be the likely head of the antitrust subcommittee on the House Judiciary Committee saying, forget all that. I mean, Google is too big, and we're going to be looking at it in terms of antitrust when we get a chance to, when he takes over the subcommittee in January. And that is, it's related to this. It's separate, but it's another kind of regulation. And, Tim Wu, who is the Columbia law professor who popularized the concept of net neutrality and really is the person who brought it to the public, who ended up getting it instantiated as policy, however briefly official policy, has a book out called The Curse of Bigness. He's not the only one. A series of people who are now legal scholars who have been saying that all of the big tech companies are too big and they need to be broken up just the way all the big trusts in the early 20th century had to be, and that'll be a good and glorious thing. What's kind of nervous making about that is, from a libertarian perspective, you understand that most of those trusts were not broken up. It didn't help anybody other than the government and the businesses themselves, for the most part, to be regulated that way. But it's starting to gain adherence across the political right as well, partly because of what Peter's talking about, that this is ultimately kind of culture war rather than demonstrating that somehow customers are worse off.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of chime in on something that we touched on, but I think it's important to be super clear, which is there is no evidence that Google or other platforms are manipulating elections for Democrats. There is no evidence that Google is manipulating elections for Democrats.
There's bad evidence.
So let me say the thing, which is that there is evidence of bias. There is evidence that the results are biased, but there is evidence of bias in all kinds of, there could be evidence for bias in all kinds of ways that are not intentional action by the owners or manipulators of those platforms. And I think that's a really, really, really important distinction. So, for instance, Google relies on what they consider to be reliable sources. And for instance, the New York Times is a reliable source. That is actually true. The New York Times is a reliable source. It's probably the most reliable source. Even if you have beef with it, it is a good newspaper.
Liberal.
That has truth in it a lot. And it is also kind of lefty. And so if you rely on this reliable source regularly, you might say, oh, look, that results in a bias in the search results. That is a very, very different thing than Google doing what many, many conservatives now routinely allege, or even now what I think is just assumed to be true on the right, which is that Google is like deleting good things about Donald Trump from the autofill type manipulation. And it's just really, really important, I think, to say, like, that's not happening. The thing that is happening that humans are doing that I do think people on the right should be worried about is dealing with, quote unquote, safety concerns. So this is the hate speech stuff. This is sometimes trends into the child pornography area. Sometimes it crosses into drug stuff even. But the decisions that have to be made about whether something violates the terms of service in terms of speaking about or endorsing viewpoints about things you can say or not say. Global warming is another example where, like, there's a human intervention that involves judgment. There, I do think it's legitimate to talk about and be worried about bias. That is really happening. But it's just so, so important to say, like, there's no evidence. There's no good evidence that these companies are actually manipulating search results.
And part of this goes back to Donald Trump, too, who in August, I believe, tweeted something that like 96% of Google search results were biased against him. And this was based on...
About Google News, I think, specifically.
This was based just like on no meaningful evidence, a bunch of bad reports by slightly kooky folks on the right. And it's so there's a Donald Trump angle to this,
there is a
of
Trump
course,
angle. But
as
I think
always.
It's just really important to note, like, the thing that people often think of as the uncontroversial part of the role of Google or other platforms in monitoring speech, which is like, well, we're just taking out the parts where people threaten each other or say like really, really bad things. Like, actually, that's the place I think where there is potentially more problematic interference, like the existence of autocompletes that are like Hillary Clinton, awesome, Hillary Clinton, second coming of Jesus, Hillary Clinton, first woman president. Like, that's not a problem. That's not where the bias is happening.
Nick, Peter name checked the Trump impact here over the weekend, I think, after Saturday Night Live came out with a It's a Wonderful Life parody. Parody is a strong word. About Donald Trump.
Segment.
He tweeted segment. Thank you. A real scandal is the one-sided coverage hour by hour of networks like NBC and Democrat spin machines like Saturday Night Live. It is all nothing less than unfair news coverage, and Dem commercials should be tested in courts. Can't be legal. Only defame and belittle. Collusion. I bring this up partly because it's funny, as always, but it's striking how many of the long-held and long-fought kind of a belief systems among conservatives in Washington having to do with media policy, being against the fairness doctrine, being against the equal time provision, for example, on and on and on, and you know, being skeptical of antitrust. These things have been brought up very specifically by the sitting president as stuff that we need to rip up and start over again. Do you worry, Nick, that what we might see is a president changing the public opinion of a party, which is already, you know, a very strongly anti-media party, so that 10 years from now, there are no new Ajit Pais? There are no people who came up through the ranks having these very strong, you know, Thomas Hazlettian ideas about media regulation, because the Republican Party that they grew up with was just trying to punch every journalist in the face, sometimes literally. And so they don't really have these kind of intellectual ideas that they had other, you know, that up until the more recent vintage conservatives had for a long time.
Yeah, I absolutely. And I think it's also partly because they're, you know, there's a willingness on the side of the new media companies, and obviously NBC is not a new media company, but the way in which, you know, nobody watches Saturday Night Live anymore on Saturday night. You watch it on your phone in a clip that you might have from YouTube or someplace else or anything. But all of these companies are signaling, you know, I mean, they're not, I mean, they've openly said and embraced some kind of regulation. And I think you have at this point a populist moment, and it's not just in the United States, and it's not just in the Republican Party, but where you pop one of the generators of populism is a lack of feeling of a lack of control over life, and it can take on a right wing or a left wing thing, but it's like, you know, populists like to control things like mass media. They don't like, you know, they don't like a lot of different people having access or control. And you might, you know, you'd prefer it if it's Father Coughlin or if it's, you know, or if it's Huey Long, depending on your politics. But in the end, what you're interested in is kind of creating a set number of speakers who kind of fulfill whatever is considered the legitimate range of opinions. So I can totally see something happening where Trump, along with Democrats and along with Republicans, come up with new guidelines for decency and for this and for that. I don't think it'll stick, because I think, you know, the internet is still too decentralized, and we are getting to a point now where what's exciting, and which hasn't been being talked about really at all for a variety of reasons, but is the coming rollout of 5G technology, which will actually allow for a kind of more decentralized and dispersed set of internet activities, including how data is stored and how data is or messages and communications just kind of get dispersed. So I think you're absolutely right, and it's a bad thing. But it's also it'll slow certain things down. I don't think it'll end anything. The other thing that I would say here is that we're also coming at the age of, you know, when you look at companies like Google or Alphabet and Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, it is true also that they bear some responsibility for not really doing very well in terms of protecting their, you know, their customers. For the most part, I don't think people really care, but they've done some pretty bad jobs that keep coming out about like keeping certain types of information private and stuff like that. So they're kind of putting themselves in a really negative position where it actually makes sense for them to play along with the government, if only to get away from having to deal with, you know, their own internal problems of delivering the products that they want.
Speaking of the tension between a populist moment and kind of a more elite sense, we saw on Friday the announcement of the shuttering of the Weekly Standard magazine, one of our competitors out there in the opinion magazine, political magazine circuit, a place where we all know people who work there. And Catherine worked there when she was like 10 years old, scrubbing out the toilets of empire over there. Just kind of wondering to get some thoughts and beginning with Catherine. I think you were at the wake on Friday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there was some debate about whether it was a wake or a shiva, which seems extremely Weekly Standard. Yeah. So, you know, I worked there. I started my journalism career there. I worked there from right when I graduated college for about 3 years. I was the fact checker for a while, a role that Facebook subsequently hired the Weekly Standard to fill on their behalf for the conservative side of America. So I'd like to think I set down some important groundwork there. You know, I was struck by, you know, as we were sort of gearing up for this and as word got out about how, you know, this news might be coming, there was, I think, a very interesting three-part cycle of, like, first it was the politicization of everything. And it was like, oh, they're anti-Trump and now they're dead. And, of course, on Saturday morning, Donald Trump tweeted his delight at the death of the Weekly Standard and its failed prognosticating, which is... frankly, a pretty fancy word for Trump, come to think of it. But so like first there was this like, oh, this is all because of Trump because everything is because of Trump. And then there was sort of a follow on discussion that was like, well, actually, this might be because of the media landscape, because the competition in the media landscape is tricky and nobody makes money, including us. We're a nonprofit. You should give us money. And so this was really all about the media landscape. And then there is the sort of, I think, inevitable thing that happens in cases like this where people say, no, this was about the bad suits. And that's kind of where people were a bit at the wake. They were like, this was bad sort of middle management, upper management decision making. It was, you know, mean and short-sighted. And this was fueled in part by the fact that they were called into a meeting at 10:30 on a Friday morning and told, your publication doesn't exist anymore. Clean out your offices by 5. And that doesn't feel good.
That's like 6.5 hours.
Yeah. And actually one of the beefs was, and they weren't even given boxes. Which is like, you know, this is the kind of thing where I think, you know, it's sort of, you know,
they were flown on first class boxes for 23 years, man.
So like the, you know,
this is
the
why you need to carry canvas bags with you everywhere.
Yeah,
Catherine.
Geez, yeah, I know
you're a plastic bag fanatic, yeah, frankly, but
you could carry. Think of how many plastic bags you could carry with you instead of carrying a
canvas grocery bag.
Gross. Anyway,
always useful. They're better than towels.
Here's my funereal thought for the Weekly Standard, which is also, I think, a thought for those of us still alive, which is the Weekly Standard was in the classic mold of magazines, including ours: politics in the front, books and arts in the back. And I think That's really underestimated as a form of talking about politics. I mean, to package always your politics with the liberal and the humane and to say life is not always politics. Life is not always shouting at each other about stupid politics. There are also books to read. There are also long form interviews to check out. Like, people are interesting in the world and deserve to be engaged over and above who they voted for or why, or who they're siding with in this fight right now. And the Weekly Standard fought viciously in the fights it fought in, but it by design engaged with people also on a bunch of other levels. I think we try to do that at Reason, and I worry always for that model, because there are plenty of people who do only want to shout at each other about politics and never look at the world outside.
Peter, you've been involved with failed right of center media startups in the past.
Oh, have I?
When you see the inevitable, David Brooks column about the corporate drones, man, who killed it. I think Max Boot had some piece in the Washington Post. When you see the over-indexed reaction to the death, or even in the New Republic's case, the kind of transformation of something that had been elite, do you just start cursing to yourself and saying, where was your op-ed about Culture 11, man?
So that's a really a deep Suderman cut that I think everybody on this podcast knows about, but the listeners probably don't. So very brief refresher.
Because literally no one remembers Culture 11.
In 2008, I believe, 2007, 2008, there was a startup online right-ish of center, let's say just sort of more broadly non-liberal publication called Culture 11 that I worked at with folks like James Poulos and Connor Friedersdorf. It didn't last even a full year in its kind of final publication state. The financial crisis kind of did us in. There were supposed to be, we were promised that there was a solid 18 months of money, no matter what happens. And then some mistakes were made, and we don't need to do a full postmortem. But there was, in fact, a full postmortem in the Washington Monthly, of all places, which was kind of fun. And Andrew Sullivan was a big fan of ours, so he was our David Brooks. So I guess, when I look at this, I think it's a real shame. And while I, in some ways, understand the kind of financial forces that led this to happen, which is to say that running these magazines, publishing these magazines isn't cheap. They lose money. And somebody has to be willing to lose money, whether it's a large group of donors who are giving money to help keep a publication afloat, as in the case of Reason, which donors, thank you very much. Or in the case, whether it's a sort of a corporate apparatus, which was the case with the Weekly Standard, which also owns the Washington Examiner and is launching a new, I believe, weekly magazine under the umbrella of the Washington Examiner that is going to be a national publication. And people who have subscriptions to the Weekly Standard, their subscriptions will be fulfilled with this publication. It's just an expensive business, and so I get the kind of corporate imperatives here. On the other hand, I think that my understanding of this situation is that there really was a kind of nasty back and forth between the upper middle management of the media company that owned the Weekly Standard, the Weekly Standard's management, in which the owners did not behave in ways that made a lot of sense, or that were particularly nice, that they were asking for things that were kind of absurd. And the Weekly Standard folks, coming out of a small magazine culture, which is which is consistently pretty independent, there were some clashes there, and I think that was a big part of what led to the demise. But it's just it's a shame, because the Weekly Standard, for all of their many many flaws, for their ideologue, for the ways that they went wrong and probably played a large, though perhaps not pivotal, but large role in getting the United States into a very bad war in Iraq, they were also a good literary magazine that published a bunch of really smart writers who doing great writing in a kind of classic magazine format. And there just aren't that many jobs left, right, center, at all, where you can do that. There aren't many publications that make that a priority. The weekly standard did for decades.
Are you going to stand for that? Or I mean, because you know, I have friends at or who were at the Weekly Standard, and I feel bad for them. I don't. I think Philip Anschutz, it was his magazine. He could flush it down the toilet if he wanted, and said he's taking the bones of it and using it to, you know, build out the subscription base for the new magazine. I think we should be a little more cold-hearted on this. You know, over the years, the Weekly Standard was an unrelenting voice for American empire and for a stupid form of national greatness that advances nothing at all from a libertarian perspective, or I even think from a good conservative point of view. They published a case for censorship. While David Frum was still friendly with them, every, you know, 8 months or 18 months, they would publish the case against libertarianism. And I'm not saying I spit on their grave, but it's like, you know, these things happen. The good people will go on. And, what do you want to, you know, what more can you say about this kind of stuff?
I think you can split the argument here. On the one hand, ideologically, I just wildly disagreed with the things that they were known for most and with kind of a lot of their editorial line. On the other hand, sort of in terms of the craft of producing a magazine, the craft of long form journalism, they did really exemplary work for decades, published some truly great writers doing some truly great writing.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that we're losing, that is hard to get back, and that we should have, as writers, just forget as human beings, as writers, as people who do this, who aspire to do this, we should have some sympathy, some empathy.
I absolutely do.
Yeah, I mean, I actually mostly want to take issue with your characterization of them being the stupidest case for anything. I mean, they might have been the wrongest case for a lot of things, but they were never the stupidest.
The cases, because they were building cases against China. They were not the smartest case for the Iraq war. What's the Iraq war? I mean, what's the smart case for the Iraq war?
I think you can think that the Iraq war was not a good idea, but I don't. But they didn't. There were a bunch of people acting in good faith, making smart, structured arguments for this thing that they thought was good.
I'd argue they're acting in blind faith.
I went back and reread some of these.
Not in good faith. In blind faith.
Dudes, this is the problem. You guys are the problem.
No, wait. I'm not the problem.
Faith. Why Nick would we not
the
assume?
No, they yeah, have they true. Changed anything about anything? And they were right before 9/11. They were, Bill Kristol couldn't go a week without talking about how we had to turn our military and empire ambitions towards China. China was the problem. It's like they have the Weekly Standard has a blind faith in an American empire, America as the essential nation, the indispensable nation that needs to constantly be projecting itself out into the world in a way that was consistent with the Cold War. I don't mourn for a second the demise of that voice in that package. Kristol will still be around.
I do, and
Steve
I think
Hayes
you are
will.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Because right. I think that there's I think there's a you know, there's also a part of the coalition that they were, which was the node of our influence. Like, I think that's the other thing that you're missing here is, like, I came through the Weekly Standard. Like, they were, for all of their failings, a child of fusionism, if not themselves fusionist, in the same way that a classic National Review is fusionist. They published, during my time there, many, many, many articles about things that we could easily publish in Reason today. Now, certainly, again, not everything, but I think the idea, certainly, but I think the idea of, hey, 24-year-old Catherine, go write a profile of Paul Ryan, that's why there are many, many people who still see libertarians as part of the coalition of the right, and why people on the right are still friendlier to libertarians than people on the left. And again, I agree with you. They were wrong about so many things, like a lot of things. But I think they were wrong in the service of what they believed was the best world. They were trying to create their best world. And people think that about us all the time, too, Nick, right? Like, if you read Reason and you don't agree with us, you could have two ways to read Reason. And one could be, these jerk faces, they have these obsessions, and they're always just arguing, and they pick new. Or you could believe what's true, which, you know, is, I can vouch for the fact that it's true, which is that we are always here arguing for sometimes our hobby horses, sometimes articles of faith, but a vision of a better world that we are trying to bring about. And I think that the same is absolutely true of the Standard.
I encourage people while the archives are still online, and I don't presume that's going to last much longer, to go. You can look at their cover gallery, and you have to keep like expanding it at the bottom of the page. But I spent some time over the weekend looking at some of their immediately post 9/11 cover images, you know, cover lines on to Iran. This is like in, you know, April or March of 2002. Like, we're not let's just keep going. We haven't even started yet. Some of those pieces, the tone of it, like Max Boots wrote one in October of 2001, talking about the case for U.S. American imperialism, and the kind of the breeziness, the casualness of the tone, you know, cover images of George Bush as the liberator, all this kind of stuff. For a good year and a half, 2.5, 5 years, it's amazing. It'll call you back to a time when kind of the whole country went mad, I think. And just like, yeah, you know, just like we pacified Germany and Japan, we'll be able to do it first in Afghanistan, then we'll be able to do it over there. And I like the assumptions that went into every single sentence about what could happen there. You read it now, and it actually reads like not a particularly good argument. It's like on its face, holy crap, that they really believe that. And of course, yes, in addition to this, they also published wonderful pieces by Matt Labash and a bunch of other people that we enjoy. But it's amazing to see some of that writing back then. And I know, I'll put it this way to put a button on it. When I was editor of Reason from 2008-2016, give or take, I saw pretty much as my ideological like opponent out there in the world, and this is the case of the two books that I've had a hand in writing in, was the Weekly Standard version of kind of neoconservatism and anti-individualism more than anyone else. And at the same time, I thought that was the best magazine in our competitive set.
What do you guys think, though, of, you know, the demise of the Weekly Standard, and obviously it's, you know, it's overdetermined. There are multiple factors, but the actual failure of the foreign policy vision, which drove that magazine. I mean, it was more ultimately about foreign policy than other things, although there were, you know, long periods where the back of the book was great and various things. But how much did the failure of their foreign policy vision weaken the Republican Party in a way that actually allowed Donald Trump to take it over? Because like if the Republican Party hadn't blown everything in the 21st century in terms of, you know, we fucked up the Afghanistan invasion, we fucked up the Iraq invasion, we started expanding into other things. George W. Bush left office the most hated president in like, you know, recent or all time American history, primarily because of foreign policy failures and the things that went along with that, defending torture and doing this and doing that. At the same time, Crystal was an early, you know, would lay claim to finding Sarah Palin and helping injecting a kind of idiotic populism into the Republican Party. But it's, you know, this is one of the things that bothers me about a lot of the people who are bemoaning the death of the Weekly Standard. They're like also trying to elide the idea that somehow the Republican Party's current position has nothing to do with their massive foreign policy failures. And that's apart from various economic other issues.
I think there's a bunch of things you can lay at the Weekly Standard's door, but I don't know why we would bother to try to lay the election of Donald Trump at their door. I mean,
What I'm saying is the Republican Party ceased becoming a serious party.
They sow the seeds of their own demise?
I mean, yeah, I guess I think like to the extent that the Weekly Standard was part of the conversation on the part of conservative and Republican elites, which it absolutely was, then it's implicated in
but
that.
Crystal but was, let's be clear, pretty influential in making Sarah Palin the vice presidential.
But he had just as many countervailing elitist threads. He absolutely inveighed against the, you know, the reality show school of politics in many, many, many forms.
Like Bill Buckley was against the Iraq war. I mean, a lot of old school,
here's the other thing that, that people don't think about is that, and in many cases, no, is that a number of the most well-known writers at the Weekly Standard had qualms with the Iraq War, and that's not what they were writing about. It was not the standard, it was not a universal staff position. Writers should speak for themselves. I don't want to sort of get into every detail of their, of exactly who thought what, but like, it was not just that the Weekly Standard as a completely cohesive unit was universally behind Bill Kristol's vision of what foreign policy
was. At the same time, though, it was a manifestation of Bill Kristol's vision. I mean, what you say is 100% true. Also true of the drug war, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention that.
And, you know, I think that's worth considering. But, you know, many magazines, ours included, I think, are more than their top editor's voice. They're a home for many voices. The Weekly Standard, similar, I think, to National Review under Bill Buckley, was mostly Bill Kristol's voice. And again, I agree with you that Bill Kristol's voice did not always speak the principles that the people on this podcast share. But I think,
the Republican Party is in a weird place, to say the least. And they've been overtaken by somebody who 10 years ago, it's inconceivable that he would have. How much did the seriousness with which, you know, that the establishment in the Republican Party could be taken how much of that is related to their absolute and complete foreign policy failures, which were coming out of, you know, part of the same zone that Kristol vision, or what became identified as a Weekly Standard vision of American greatness, both here and abroad. I think that's worth asking. And again, I'm not doing this out of a cheapness. I'm just saying that it's like, you know, we're struggling. We have a Democratic Party, which is about to, you know, it seems to be embracing a kind of, a great society program 2.0 mentality, which is not going to end well for them. But, you know, these large lumbering forces within the two major parties are, you know, it's worth kind of thinking about, you know, are they fit for the 21st century? Because, you know, what the Weekly Standard was pushing was a foreign policy that extended very much out of the Cold War. But, you know, the Cold War is different. Maybe we need a radically different foreign policy.
I think it's safe to say that the elites blew it. Both parties, the elites blew it, and we wouldn't have a populist moment without the sense of not just that the elites blew it, but that the life that we've been living in this country and the life of politics and economics has been dissatisfying. And so my constant kind of the nag at me when I see people whose critiques of Donald Trump I share, largely, and I would include in that Bill Kristol and some of these other people, I want them to cop to some of their own failures. And for the most part, and this is much broader than Weekly Standard people here, to be sure, to be clear, you don't see that. And so it's instead, hey, let's just reclaim, you hear this from Tom Nichols, right? The author of The Death of Expertise. It's like, let's just reclaim the Republican Party. We're going to rebuild it after the Trump era is over, and we're going to rebuild it, based on this more robust American, essential internationalism. It's like, no, we actually should. That's a debate you got to rewin because you lost it. Right. Like that contributed to it. I'd like to see more humility from those people instead of just saying, hey, look at this appalling cretin who I disagree with here. I want to cut this part of the conversation short because we're getting up against an hour. I want to hear from Peter Suderman how great the Spider-Man puppet movie is or whatever the hell happened over the weekend.
There's no puppets involved. It's an animated Spider-Man movie featuring about a half a dozen different Spider-Mans. It's called Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's probably the best Spider-Man movie, certainly the best superhero movie of the year.
Peter recommended it to my 5-year-old on Sunday.
But this is part of what's great. So this is a PG-rated kid movie for kids, definitely appropriate and in some ways aimed at kids. But what I would actually say is that this is we are long familiar sort of in the Pixar era. We are going on 20 plus years, maybe 30 at this point, of kind of kids' movies that adults can appreciate too. And that goes back all the way, you know, to stuff like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, right? I mean, which, you know, featured, among other things, to bring it back to a topic we just raised, Robin Williams doing a William F. Buckley impression in the middle of Aladdin. Just
That's
like,
true.
Take,
That's 100% true.
Just take a minute and remember that that actually happened, and the animators were like, oh, sure, he did that in the booth. I guess we'll just draw the genie doing that and leave it in the movie. So we're very familiar with this idea of kids' movies that adults can appreciate. But I'd actually say that we're starting to get into with Into the Spider-Verse and with some of the stuff that Netflix is doing, we're getting into adult animation that is also appropriate for kids. And this is, I think, this is a movie that captures kind of the spirit and vibe of some of the best Spider-Man comic books, a kind of hyper-reality that's disconnected from the kind of literalism that that defines the Marvel live-action movies, and really does a great job of kind of getting it the energy and the energy of Spider-Man the character, but also the malleability of the character, the way that he is a little more than just sort of he's not just Peter Parker, this one guy who comes from a specific part of New York and has this very specific set of relationships. He is an idea, a mantle that can be taken on by nearly anyone. And in fact, in this movie, what we see are different variations on the theme of Spider-Man and what he is and what he or she or it, because one of them is a pig, can be.
Nick, what cultural products have you been consuming?
I finished Norman Mailer's An American Dream, which is an absolutely terrible novel that he wrote as a serial for Esquire magazine. I highly recommend it to people because it will transport you to a world that you couldn't imagine and wouldn't imagine in a million years. And I'm actually starting in currently on his Armies of the Night, his nonfiction novel about Pentagon protests in the mid-60s or late-60s.
Which I remember as an absolute classic book. So I don't want you to come back here and tell me that it was, you know, as bad as Of a Fire on the Moon.
I will review it in the third person as he writes about himself
as Aquarius.
Yes.
Can we also take this occasion to quote what happened when the great Dorothy Parker met Norman Mailer for the first time, which is that she said, oh, yeah. So you're the man who can't spell fuck.
Right.
Because, of course, he used fug throughout
his publisher
famous,
and
the
Naked
and
the
Dead.
No, that's very true.
Catherine, have you been reading any wife stabbers in your spare time?
You know, I usually, but this week I was listening to Drew Carey's new-ish radio show. I have a little brief review of it in the magazine, but he has a Sirius XM show called The Friday Night Freakout. And even though my heart is cold and dead and I don't really appreciate the beauty or emotional power of music, it seemed like it was a pretty good radio show that had lots of good old timey rock and roll, which I enjoyed. So
can you just attempt to kind of put a what type of rock and roll?
Old-timey. Isn't that enough for you?
Well, there's the 1930s, 50s,
classic.
70s.
This is
lots of bands with the word "the" at the beginning of their names. Is that helpful?
Okay. Yeah. Wait, like the Beaver Brown Band.
The Dogs. The
Who?
4291s. The whatevers. Yeah.
The
I don't know.
4291s.
It's not a real band. I just made that up. The
Boat Brummels.
There's very little Drew Carey talking, which is disappointing to me. I thought I was going to get more Drew Carey banter for my listening hour, but apparently some people like to listen to the radio to listen to music. So
he's more like just a DJ, like playing.
He's a DJ.
Track.
He's just a DJ. He gives you little tidbits of information between the tracks, but mostly it's just playing you some tunes.
Drew Carey playlist.
My cultural product was just simply a. an outtake from a Phoenix, or not an outtake, but a snippet from a Phoenix City Council meeting where like an 86-year-old woman got up and absolutely dressed down the owner of the Phoenix Suns over state arena welfare with just talking about his shoes squeaking. It is a terrific rant that cuts through. You know, we've been writing that reason for 25 years about the persistent idiocy and boondoggles and corruption associated with all of this corporate welfare over the years. And it kind of can make your eyes glaze over usually. And this woman in 1.5 minutes makes the best single case for it. You will hear it'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. And it'll make you think of how much money and time has been wasted giving a lot of welfare to super rich people. That's all the riches that we have time to talk about here on The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us over at Apple Podcasts and also on Spotify, speaking of music. And stay tuned the rest of the week for various things. We're going to gear up for a special end of the year podcast, right? Some kind of a New Year's thing.
Some kind.
So you'll have that to look forward to. And thanks for listening, and see you next time. Goodbye.